Welcome back, everybody. We're on class four, so we're just heading into the middle of this unit, which, as you've probably gathered, is a really full-on intense unit. And I've been feeling really sorry for everyone because I thought, oh, it's just too much each class, it's just too much. And then I was looking at what I could cut out, and then I was like, trying to cut off your own limbs. It's like, no, I can't cut that out, I can't cut that out. And then I realized that actually it is so full on because what we're doing is all the topics of discovering Buddhism in one unit from the point of view of Tantra. So it actually is putting everything in there really intense. So I've given us and myself a little bit of leeway that we'll probably go over about 15 minutes each night because even though Mandy has informed me that when she types up Eddie's classes, about 3,000 words. And when she typed up my class, it was between 8,000 and 9,000 words. So I am really trying to shove everything in there and talk as fast as I possibly can. But what to do? So we'll do the best that we can. So we're on class four, and just as a reminder of what we've already covered, which are the really big discovering Buddhism topics. So we looked at the six names of Tantra, which is pretty much the unique qualities of the tantric path, why it is so special, so rare, so amazing. We looked at what makes Tantra virtuous, which is the foundation of the three principal aspects of the path. So, renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view, the view of emptiness. So, with those three things, then the foundation. It makes a really virtuous, strong, positive foundation so things can turn out well. And if we don't have those things, then it's a very rocky road and can lead to disaster. We've looked at the qualities of a student, the responsibilities of a student, what we have to do from our own side, which is what we have to do first, so that we actually take responsibility for our own experience, and then how to check out a teacher and check that the Vajra master, that the teacher is a valid Mahayana guru, and there's a checklist. So it's not just chance and charisma, it's that too, but there's also a checklist. Because if we get committed, if we take an initiation and we have someone now as our Vajra master, and then we start regretting it, then that's a really serious downfall. It's really bad for our own mind, so it's much better to avoid it. And then we looked last week at the three gates to enter Tantra, the three gateways or kind of checkpoints that we pass through to be able to say, for instance, have an empowerment entering the tantric path. So what are they? Can anyone remember what the three gates are? Is she right? Refuge,
Yes.
bodhicitta, and empowerment. And is it in that order?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. And can you have an empowerment without taking refuge? Because even if you're at an empowerment and you've never taken refuge before, refuge will be given and the bodhicitta vows will be given. They just might be very fast, so you pass through those checkpoints, those gates very quickly, but they absolutely happen. And so then following on today, what we're going to look at, how much bliss can we handle before we go berserk? So this is tackling the question of how well do we handle desirous energy at present? How long until we go berserk? Tantra is known as the path with the practices containing desire. So how do we actually use that desire? How does it work? And what's your pleasure threshold? Because we understand a pain threshold, don't we? And so some of us have a low pain threshold, and some of us have a high pain threshold. So it's how much pain we can take before we go berserk. So, like, who's got a really low pain threshold? Hands up. Okay, only a few. Who's got like what you think is a medium pain threshold? One, two, three. Who's got a really high pain threshold? Okay, so there we go. And we all know, don't we? We've got an idea from our experience. And it's because it's in our best interests to not lose our mind when we're experiencing pain, because we have to be able to help ourselves or get ourselves to help. But exactly the same thing happens with pleasure, with experiences that are pleasant. How much can we handle before we lose our mind, before we get completely involved in worldly concerns or craving and grasping or doing all sorts of kind of negative activities to get more pleasure, all of that kind of thing. Lamayeshi quote, yeah. Right. So our mind runs after ideas as intensely as our tongue hungers for taste, as we just, hunger for entertainment. And yeah, so the internal distractions, the distractions of the mind, which are very easy to get involved in the modern world. And because it's a pleasant feeling, there is no incentive for us to actually take control of our mind, because we just think, oh, just have more and more fun things, it'll be great. And then later on, we get the experience of all the rest that comes along with it, and we go, what happened? So if we're going to use the energy of desire on the path, we've got to make sure that we do it without going nuts. From a tantric point of view, we can use every emotion on the path, so not just pleasant experiences, but also other emotions, jealousy and anger as well. So we'll talk about that in a bit. And we'll also talk about what are called the four classes of tantra. So you've heard of lower tantra or high yoga tantra, you might have heard those words bandied around. So what distinguishes those four classes, which is to do with the capacity that you have to take the energy of desire onto the path without going berserk. So before we do that, and to give us an experiential awareness of this, but first, the smelling homework. So, did anyone remember to do the smelling homework during the week? Oh, yes. Okay. So, what's your name again? So, you had the dinner, you smell it, you appreciate it, and then how long before you ate? Right. Oh, okay. So, once the urge to eat kind of to just gobble it all down, then after that urge left, then you had the dinner.
About 3 minutes or so.
3 minutes. Must have been a good dinner.
Big enough.
Did you cook it or somebody else? Oh, excellent. Grandma's dinner. Fantastic. Okay, excellent. So who else with the smelling homework, which, just to remind everyone, changing yum of I wanted to what a nice experience and how you did it. Yeah, so Stefan, how did you go? Oh, food intolerance. Excellent. So when you smell the hot chocolate, what happens? What's the process you go through?
Nowadays, there's not, it's, I don't know, like I don't really feel it.
So you smell the hot chocolate, but it's not delicious smelling anymore.
It's fine smelling,
It's fine smelling.
like it's a
Yeah.
nice smell,
Yeah.
but I don't want it. Like I don't,
Okay.
you know, it doesn't.
So it smells nice and you don't want it. And is that because it's a food allergy? Okay. And so with food allergies, as we know, it's like you're aware of the consequences. And so the natural restraint happens. Yeah.
Over time,
Over
you know,
time.
it wasn't
Okay.
always like this.
Okay.
Like
Chris,
my
yeah.
face. I feel like my face initially was, I guess,
Oh,
like
okay. So I can't
kind
remember in Spirited Away,
of
No Face, but.
like
So when he goes further away,
my
he recovers his
recovers his senses.
senses and his equilibrium. Okay.
Yeah, I've been
Yeah. Yeah. So if you were surrounded by all the cookies and the chocolates and things, like we've just had Easter and it was all the beautiful smells and it was all like Lindt chocolate and it was washing over you and you're really hungry, what would happen to you?
all
Oh, so you do have the chocolate. Okay, and you're not interested in those in the wheat-based food because consequences. Okay. Anybody else? Tell me.
Me, it's like nothing.
Ah, oh,
It
it's
doesn't feel
nothing?
good. It doesn't, like,
Right.
pulse back.
So she thought you were a little bit weird just sniffing that chocolate and then putting it down.
She was here, so she knew.
Oh, okay.
She was like, why is your face
chocolate? Okay. Mandy, so physiologically you have no sense of smell because of COVID in 2023. So how's that, how is it when you can't smell anything? How's it changed things?
It's changed everything because I'm not knowing, I can't smell. Like when I put, like when I have, I get out of the shower, and you said, Mum, you know, shower, so I can't smell myself. Oh.
Thanks, daughter. I love you too, that's right. So there you go. So if you go by taste, but even beforehand, if you didn't have taste, so you've got a psychological experience that comes from having a physiological lack of something. Right. Okay.
Because
it's going to be extreme cooking if you do cook. Okay.
So
oh, yeah, it can be other things. Yeah, like if someone has a really amazing smelling cigar or tobacco and you're like, oh, I might go and have. Well, that's interesting, man.
I thought the most time when they were harvest, I used to love smelling it, but I never smelled it.
Yeah.
But I loved smelling it, and I did go next
step
and smoke it.
So was that because you had a physiological effect or because it was just good associations mentally?
This is why I'm wondering if there's another level to smell it. I really love the smell.
I remember as a child loving the smell. My parents drove into the petrol station. They filled the car up with petrol. Oh. And that smell was just so fantastic. The spirit copier, the Gestetner, and the la la la, all of those things, yes. So, we grasp it more smell. So I'm not sure if smelling all that petrol was actually a good thing. So... Okay. So we've got a general gist. So here's a way that we can think about it with the smelling assignment. So of course, with a worldly approach, when we, you know, like if we're really hungry and the next door neighbors are cooking an amazing dinner, an incredible curry or something, it can drive you insane and it can make you really upset. So because it's contact. And then feeling, then craving, then grasping. That's the general progression. That's the worldly progression that happens. And we also think, of course, that because the smell is delicious, the pleasure is coming from there. Or as B. Alan Wallace says, we think the pleasure is in the cake or the pleasure is in the curry. So that's the general worldly one. But then the Hinayana approach is this, lower scope practices in common with the Hinayana practices. Lower scope practices is about restraining the mind and restraining ourselves physically as well. And so food intolerances are fantastic for that because we remember we've got the two things happening, the pleasure, the smell, and then we're remembering the future consequences. And that's, folks, how we deal with karma, isn't it? We've got the thing that we have the urge we want to do, and then we remember the future consequences, and it just naturally stops us doing it. So the allure of the beautiful smell kind of subsides because we remember the really hideous consequences that are going to come, and we're over it. So we're over the cause of the suffering. Then I suppose the middle scope would be to be able to meditate on the emptiness of the smell. Where does the smell actually originate from anyway? What's it made up of? All of those things. Is the experience in the smell? Is it outside of the smell? All of the analysis that we can do. But there's another way that we can look at it as well, which so from the perfection vehicle, the higher scope, many of us would use this smell, we'll try and use the eating as a fuel, so as a fuel to benefit others. So I think one of you said that before. So that's why we eat, a Mahayana way of eating. But with the smell, you can also do that because you can think, may everyone enjoy the smell without grasping. May everybody have the enjoyment of the Dharma just like I'm enjoying this smell. May everyone enjoy the Dharma and may I be the one to bring it to them. We can also recognize, probably like middle scope would be recognizing that any joy that we get from this smell is the result of our own virtue. It's not the result of the smell. It's the result of our virtue. And so may we continue to create virtue. May we help others create virtue. But really the perfection vehicle is about using it, any nice experience to really enjoy the experience, even just putting your head on the pillow and going, oh, thank God, after a big long day. Then you think, may everybody enjoy the restful bliss of nirvana. So the joy reminds you to practice generosity and it fuels you to do that. Wait, that's not all. Then we've got, from the mantra point of view, from the point of view of a tantric path, that smell is the blissful play of appearances within emptiness. So it's based on restraint and altruism. So it's based on the lower scope and the higher scope paths. But what it is a blissful play of appearances within emptiness. And so you don't see it in an ordinary way. You would spontaneously enjoy it, recognize it, that it's empty nature, and spontaneously share it with others. But it's, who are the others? Well, they're Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And who am I? Who's the I that's sharing? Buddha and a Bodhisattva as well. So you're the deity and they're the deity, and you're enjoying all the enjoyments and sharing them in the nature of emptiness. So the blissful experience reminds you about appearances within emptiness. So what happens is any blissful experience reminds you about emptiness. So it causes your wisdom to grow. Yeah.
Is that saying that like appearances are necessarily blissful?
Appearances are the blissful part of emptiness, of the union of bliss and emptiness. Yep. And because in Tantra the two happen at the same time, appearances whilst empty. Whereas in the perfection vehicle, it's first appearances, then emptiness, one after the other, and they alternate. But in Tantra, that's at the same time. And so then because it is appearances within emptiness and everything is naturally blissful, then whether it's the smell of cake or whether it's the smell of dog shit, you still go, beautiful.
Any smell.
So it's kind of good that we've gone through all of this, because we'll see how naturally we're very used to having either the Hinayana approach, that the lower scope practices in common with the lower scope, which is restraining ourselves, or the Mahayana, which is then sharing, using it for fuel to help others. But very rarely do we kind of transform it into this tantric approach. So that's what we're going to look at tonight. So you can keep doing the smelling homework. Let's do our motivation prayers. So refuge in bodhicitta, the Mahayana refuge in bodhicitta. Sangye chidang sokye chonam chanchu patu tani kyapsu chi taki chenye kepe sonam ki trola penje sangye tropa shu sangye chidang sokye chonam chanchu patu tani kyapsu chi Taki chenye kepe sonam ki Drola penche sangye dropa shoy Sangye chedan soke chonam lai Chanchu padui tani kyap sui chi Taki chenye kepe sonam ki Trala penche sangye drupa shun. The seven limb prayer. Buso go pe go ne cha ta lo na sa mi jo cha tre ma lo do me ne sa di do tam che sha ke pa ge wa na ma che Owa ma tong pa du le ju ni Tra la cha ki ko lo ko wa ta Ta che ke nan chan chu che po no And offering a mandala Our mandala is very joyously accepted. So let's look at desire as fuel. And so there's this amazing quote from Lama Yeshe: when the intense energy of bliss is focused on emptiness, it gives rise to the wisdom that cuts the root of suffering. And so we're going to have a look at what does that mean. So this is a little bit from Lama Yeshe's Introduction to Tantra, page 29, but it's a very old edition. So it's the first page of chapter 3. As human beings, we have the capacity to enjoy limitless, blissful happiness, while at the same time remaining free of the delusions that normally contaminate our pursuit of pleasure. So we do have this potential. Contrary to what some people might believe, there is nothing wrong with having pleasures and enjoyments. What is wrong is the confused way we grasp onto these pleasures, turning them from a source of happiness into a source of pain and dissatisfaction. It is such grasping and attachment that is the problem, not the pleasures themselves. Therefore, if we could free ourselves from this habitual grasping, we could enjoy ourselves as much as we want without any of the difficulties that usually accompany our ordinary compulsive search for pleasure. With the proper understanding of transformation, whatever we do 24 hours a day can bring us closer to our goal of totality and self-fulfillment in all our actions, walking, eating, and even urinating. even in our sleep, which is usually spent in the darkness of unconsciousness or in the chaos of dreams, it can be turned into the clear light experience of subtle, penetrating wisdom. Perhaps all this sounds impossible. Certainly other more gradual spiritual approaches, including those of the sutra path of Buddhism itself, stress that desire, jealousy, and the other delusions of our daily life are always impure and should be treated as poisons. We are constantly reminded of their dangerous effects and are instructed to avoid their influence as much as possible. But as it has been pointed out already, Tantra takes a different approach. Although it also insists that delusions such as desirous attachment are the source of dissatisfaction and suffering and therefore must be overcome, it teaches skillful ways of using the energy of these delusions to deepen our awareness and speed our spiritual progress. So we're taking the energy of of blissful energy. So it's not taking the delusion itself. It's taking the energy onto the path. And it can be all of our energies that can be used to propel us. It becomes a fuel to propel us to enlightenment. So it becomes very fast and very powerful. So ordinarily, our desires and our pleasures, when we get obsessed with something, what happens, how we can tell that it's ordinary desire, is we get really tunnel vision. We kind of sink into the thing. We can't stop thinking about it. And our mind becomes narrower. And it's a restrictive obsession leading to, you know, obsession with more and more pleasure. We lose our awareness. We sink into dull stupidity. And what happens is it only increases our dissatisfaction and restlessness. So that's the dead set giveaway. So as a whole different thing, tantric bliss expands the mind. It's an experience that expands our mind to overcome limitations. So the quality of the experience is completely different. And we could even recognize this just by the quality of experience, that if we're super hungry and we just really absolutely got to eat that thing, and we just like pushing everybody else out of the way, no, no, it's mine, I want it. Or if we remembered, oh, that's right, everybody else is hungry too, and I'd like to share this beautiful thing so that everybody else has the experience. That's a much more relaxed, open, less agitated, a much more joyous, less worried state of mind, just with something simple and worldly like that. Okay, so questions or comments before we get to the next bit? How are we going? Have I put an okay case so far? Any dissenters? Yes, Ian, go for it. It's in the context of the actual tantric practice, but it's also in the context of our day-to-day activities, because they change. Our day-to-day enjoyments of things change by nature. They change. And but also it's to do with just even the meditation practices. So we get an idea, say if you just do a breathing meditation or something, and your mind becomes more still, and you actually experience how wonderful it is to be free of all of the agitation, and you have a great experience. So generally the next thing that we do the next day is we sit down and we try and replicate it. So already we're grasping at the pleasant time we had meditating, rather than recognizing, oh, that's a side effect. So that gives us an idea just with day-to-day meditations, but how much more so in the actual tantric sadhanas. If you're getting a massage and your body's becoming relaxed, and then you're thinking, may everybody else enjoy, you know,
yeah,
not having a sore neck anymore, then that's taking it to a mental thing, and so you're not focusing on your body. But, you know, so for instance, when I go get my neck done, I imagine that I'm Medicine Buddha, and I imagine that they're Medicine Buddha. So I imagine, so the massage therapist is making mountains of merit because they're actually massaging Medicine Buddha. How amazing. But then also I imagine that, well, this is me with a sore neck, and the therapist is actually Medicine Buddha doing exactly what's needed. And so it's just great. So you've got both. You've got a physical thing happening and you've got a mental thing happening. Madonna had one, yep.
An online question from Maisie Jane. Thinking about grasping, maybe grasping intensely at the Dharma itself isn't so good. Maybe we should be enjoying the Dharma without trying to possess it, possibly. Being as the Dharma itself is a dependent arising. Pratipya samuppada.
I don't know those words, but so feeling, contact, craving, grasping comes from, I mean, in a way that's talking about the nature of attachment. And attachment necessarily overestimates the value of an object and what it can bring us. And you can't overestimate the value of the Dharma. So actually, it would be great to grasp at it, because if we're going to grasp at anything, let it be the Dharma, because that'll actually help us, whereas everything else will just become more dissatisfied. So again, it's like using that thought transformation process, which is transforming the energy of grasping into something that's going to help us, and then we're actually then taking that thought transformation process and using it in tantric practice. But, you know, the better practitioner I am, the more mountains of merit they get. But they get mountains of merit thanks to Medicine Buddha.
Yes.
Not thanks to me. I'm just like the conduit.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
Okay, so more from Lama Yeshe. All this talk about instant results and the generation of incredible bliss sounds attractive, but we should not forget two very important points. First of all, although the Tummo practice and other, you know, the Sadhana practices definitely leads to the experience of bliss, its primary purpose is to enable us to enter into a state of clear light wisdom. It is this wisdom, a clear insight into the true nature of reality, that frees us from the bondage of our delusions. Bliss by itself cannot do this. Therefore, throughout our meditation, or even if it's a Tummo meditation, we must develop as strong a comprehension as possible of emptiness, of non-duality, of the non-self-existent nature of the blissful experience itself. If we follow old habits and relate to the blissful feelings as if they were concrete and self-existent, the Tummo meditation's powerful production of desirous energy will lead to disastrous results. So that's really kind of saying that any pleasant experiences are like a side effect of the meditation, and what we're using it is that energy to meditate on emptiness. That's the whole point. If we don't meditate on emptiness, we can't cut through to samsara. So furthermore, we should never be so carried away by our pursuit of bliss that we forget the motivation behind the entire practice of Tantra. The ultimate aim of the Buddhist path of both Sutra and Tantra is to be of maximum benefit to others. If we become so caught up in striving for the experience of bliss that we neglect dedicating ourselves to the welfare of others, there is absolutely no way we can ever be successful in our practices. All we'll be doing is creating the causes for yet more unhappiness and frustration. So again, it's like the three principal aspects of the path. What's motivating us is this wish to help others. And we're going to try and not get sidetracked. Lama Yeshe also says, within us all is an unlimited source of male and female energy, just as within every atom is the potential for nuclear fission. So this gives you an idea of the power of this kind of energy, of desirous energy that's within us. And I've titled this slide Longing for Union, because most of us, our first kind of feeling of wanting to be whole comes from, we kind of transmute it and think it's going to come from having a relationship. And so we have a longing for union. We want to lose ourselves and be in union. And, I mean, in a way, we're on the right track, because losing ourselves is like the very first tiny little bit of aiming towards realizing selflessness. Emptiness of the self. But we just don't know what we're doing, and we're projecting everything outwards. And this longing for union is there too. That's the seed of enlightenment that is longing to unify all of our energies. But because we're drawn outwards all the time, we think it's union with another person. And of course, that's not possible, because I'm not enlightened and they're not enlightened, so it isn't going to result in enlightenment. It's going to result in something entirely different. And so then we might think, oh, no, maybe this whole thing with relationships, it's just never going to work. My refuge is not out there. And so then we give up this longing for union. But that's also missing the point, because that actually is like a sublimated wish for enlightenment. And we've just, because we don't know any better, we've just projected onto the only thing that we know, which is relationships, the only thing that really takes us out of ourselves. So there is a transformation that we go through when we have a romance. We feel completely different. We change. But then it doesn't last because we're relying on something external to us. And so one way to go, the worldly way to go, is just to have a new relationship and go through that first flush of a romance again and feel that loss of oneself and feel that kind of union, but then it fragments, it disintegrates. We become more dissatisfied, more desperate for company. And so then we have another relationship and we think that the result, the solution is outside of ourselves. So actually, there's nothing wrong of wishing for wholeness. That's actually really healthy. But we can't find it in an ordinary relationship. We can just direct that longing to be a longing for ultimate union, which is this union of all of our masculine and feminine energies. And so this idea of nuclear fission. So I kind of like, you know, how they draw the atoms and things like that. Like, we know atoms don't exist like that. That's just a diagram. It's a pretty diagram. And we kind of understand that it represents something. So the diagrams of the deities, which are Buddhas in union, they're also a diagram. The union we're talking about doesn't look like that. It's just a diagram to give us an idea of an experience. This idea of wholeness that we can actually experience is represented in tantric art as a sexual embrace. But it's nothing to do with sex and it's nothing to do with gender. It's about this unification of energies and wholeness. And there's also quite a different cultural approach because from the Buddhist point of view, masculine is seen as the skillful means, the compassion, the blissful aspect, and the feminine is seen as the penetrative awareness and wisdom. So a little bit more like when you hear about, say, the goddess Sophia, the of wisdom. Wisdom is a feminine part of the energies. The wisdom mother, the mother of all insights, of all liberation. And then the male, the skillful means. That is true, but that's for a whole different reason why Manjushri is portrayed as male with a sword, because that's about... it's a lower tantra practice. And so again, it's the what it's doing is representing the holding the wisdom, which is in the left hand, which is the feminine side, and then holding the sword, the actual compassionate activity of cutting through the root of suffering, and that's in the right hand. So it's within there. Yep, Tom. No, I'm saying partnerships are incompatible with happiness if what we want is happiness. So all the good things that come from partnerships come from when you're not craving and grasping and when you are caring about the other person. So it's like those two forms of ordinary pleasure or pleasure that's informed by altruism and wisdom. And so, yeah, ordinary relationships are going to have ordinary results. That's it. But there's no judgment about if it's good or bad. That's just cause and effect. But we don't want ordinary results. Nobody says, I want to grow up and marry someone who's about 40% okay. No, we want the whole package, don't we? We want someone who's going to make us happy, make us laugh, be able to make us feel secure.
And be exciting.
Be exciting. And secure, all of those things all at once, and love me unconditionally. We don't actually think, well, can I offer that to you? Like, am I a good package? So, you know, there's a lot of stuff about just the nature of attachment that we have to already have our head around and already be really familiar with. The ordinary attachments appear great but don't give us the results that we want. You know, samsara's like one great big food allergy. Actually. So it doesn't mean we have to give up food. Lower scope practices. If you don't have the lower scope practices where the understanding is and where you actually learn how to restrain your physical actions and your speech and then your mind, what hope do we have to then be able to use that energy? No, no. So those lower scope practices are absolutely essential. Yeah, absolutely right. So even with ordinary relationships, I mean, you know, having sex, it activates some kind of bliss. But actually, from a tantric point of view, it's like just a poor approximation of the kind of bliss that we can actually activate within our system to meditate on emptiness, generate realizations, and become enlightened. So what we can actually activate can be something as strong as nuclear fission. But what we settle for is just like, you know, just sex in relationships, which honestly, it's like a case of the emperor's new clothes in a way. So we have an approximation and it's unreliable and we think that the pleasure comes from out there. So as we know with karma, any pleasure that we have is a result of our virtue. It's a result of us having the capacity to be able to experience pleasure. If we don't have that capacity, doesn't matter how much sex we have, we're not gonna actually feel it. With meditation on a deity, there's also a projection that happens, just like in a relationship, there's projections that happen, but it's a realistic projection. It's based on something that can actually happen. Whereas in a relationship, what we expect can't actually happen. Okay, so here's a little bit more from Lama Yeshe about this. The tantric solution to the problem of relationships is extremely radical. It involves a complete transformation of our ordinary vision. This is the central point of the tantric approach. The same desirous energy that ordinarily propels us from one unsatisfactory situation to another is transmuted through the alchemy of Tantra into a transcendental experience of bliss and wisdom. The practitioner focuses this penetrating brilliance of this blissful wisdom so that it cuts like a laser beam through all the false projections of this and that and pierces the very heart of reality. So we can see that ordinary and enlightened functions of desire are directly opposed to one another. In Tantra, the experience of the bliss that arises from desire expands the mind so we overcome all of our limitations. Whereas ordinarily, the pleasure that comes from contact with desirable objects narrows our attention and leads to a restrictive obsession for more and better pleasure. So we've got a couple of analogies. One of them, then, how we harness this kind of energy, like an insect. So an insect that's born in wood devours the wood from the inside, so it sustains itself until the wood is gone. So we're born from attachment. We're in the desire realm. The reason that, you know, we've been born into this incredibly fortuitous life, so it must have took heaps of merit. But why here? Why are we born in samsara and not in the pure lands? Because we're still propelled by desire. So we're born from attachment, but we can use the attachment to exhaust the attachment. We're born from attachment, but we use the attachment to exhaust the attachment. So we can't actually take attachment onto the path. What we're doing is we're taking the energy or the sustenance, just like the insects, they're taking the wood and they're devouring the wood till there's nothing left. So we're taking the energy of attachment onto the path, using its energy. So what we've got to remember here is it's not a method to increase our attachment, but to eliminate it. So whether it's Mahayana Sutra or Mahayana Tantra, we're eliminating attachment. But the way we go about it's really different. So in this way, we're using it. Nowhere at all are we encouraged to increase our attachment. If you ever hear that, big red flags. If increasing our attachment was the answer, we'd all be enlightened by now, right? Clearly, we'd be there. We'd be there. But no, we've just, you know, if we follow desire, we get dissatisfaction. Yeah, because having pleasant experiences, it changes us physiologically, emotionally, everything. So, for instance, if you just have to do any daily task, if it's something that you don't like or it's a bit boring, you find you're really tired when you're doing it. And it's not that joyous and your mind becomes heavy and then it leads to other things, resentment and all of these kinds of things. But if there's something that you love doing, like if you love playing music or you love crochet or you love cooking or gardening, or usually it's those so-called hobbies, if you absolutely love doing it, you can be involved in that activity for hours and the time just flies. And you're not tired. You don't notice you're tired. You don't notice you're cold. And none of those resentments build up in your mind. So that's just from enjoying something. It's easier to focus. And in fact, you might even physically get more tired, but you have more energy for the thing. Your enjoyment grows. So it's really different. And it affects our mind, it affects our emotions, and it affects our physiology as well. If we're made to do something that we absolutely hate, we can even become sick. If we're doing something we absolutely love, it can heal us. So in a way, what we're doing with the tantric approach, because we're using our physiology, this actual body-mind complex, it's like a great big biohack. We're using this physical energy, but we're, you know, taming it with our mind. Okay, so then, well, how does it all work? Here's a little chart. we're gonna capture the whole thing in a little chart. So during meditation, during the actual sadhana, and when, for instance, you're meditating on calm abiding or on the deity or developing single points of concentration, during meditation, you make the energy of desire manifest. So Lama Yeshe, in one of those previous things, was talking about Tummo, the Tummo fire, that inner fiery energy. So you actually make that very subtle physical energy manifest through meditation. Just like with calm abiding, one of the results of calm abiding is mental and physical pliancy and bliss. It's a natural result. So you make it manifest. And so then through that power of manifest desirous energy, you naturally experience bliss. That's a natural result. But instead of going, oh, wow, what a great trip, and blissing out, you conjoin bliss with the correct view. So you use that energy and you start meditating on emptiness and going through all the analysis. And what happens when everything is working harmoniously together like this is a meditative stabilization generated from bliss, cultivated as emptiness. And so this is really focused, really powerful. very sustainable, and it is this that the energy meditating on emptiness like that that actually eliminates attachment, frees us from suffering, removes all of those delusions. So I'm not going to ask, do you have any questions about this? Because this is profound, and this is like the nuts and bolts process that's within all of the sadhanas and the practices. But for those of you that like to know, well, what is actually happening, there it is. It's like a reverse vicious cycle. That's right. It's a virtuous cycle. So here's another analogy, like a vaccine. And, I mean, funnily enough, our world has so much problem even with vaccines, doesn't it? But the whole thing about a vaccine is that you actually use poison or the disease to produce medicine. That's the thing about it. And, I mean, I remember there's a movie about the development within it anyways of the smallpox vaccine. And, I mean, it was very hands-on, wasn't it? This father, he scraped the poxes and then put them on all the cut his kids, cut all the lines and stuck all the pox in the kids and hope to goodness they'd live. And thanks to karma and good luck, it was the correct amount and they did live and they developed an immunity to the pox. So what ensures that it doesn't kill us is that the whole thing is well processed. So just like a vaccine uses disease or poison to produce medicine, Tantra uses bliss arising from desire to counter desire. And how is it processed? What's the process that ensures it doesn't kill us? Is the three principal aspects of the path, or the empty view, wisdom realizing emptiness, and bodhicitta. So just like a vaccine has to be processed so you have just the right amount and you know the timing and then you have an immunity. So the same thing, you have just the right amount of blissful energy and it's processed so it's safe with wisdom realizing emptiness and bodhicitta, and then you have immunity to the actual affliction. So the point about this to remember is that Tantra does not eliminate the energy of the affliction, whereas everything in the Mahayana Sutra path does. It counteracts. Tantra actually uses it. It uses the poison. Homeopathy, very similar. Yeah, that's right. Pushing a nail out with another nail. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so I mean, in a lot of Eastern European countries and also South American countries, they use a lot of homeopathy in farming for, cattle and chickens and whatever to give them immunity. And, clearly it works. Well, I put a whole lot of nicely coloured little vials and bottles of delicious-looking stuff along the bottom there is that it's kind of like if we're sick and we go into a chemist shop and we're like, quick, give me something. And if we just grab the thing that looks pretty or the thing that looks nice, that's like grabbing the pleasurable bit of tantric practice or meditation or anything like that and just wanting the nice experience. And then we just guzzle it all down. Or, have a peyote party or multiple sexual partners or whatever it is. So we think because it appears nice that it is going to be nice. But it's not processed the right way and it's not the right dose, so it isn't going to help us. So there's the affliction, there's the energy of the affliction. And, yes, the cause of the affliction. So we have to make desire manifest. We have to actually have that energy arise. But then we're going to get rid of the affliction.
Right.
Yeah. That energy is free. Okay, so that one yet. So when we're talking about practices containing desire, actually, I mean, that's the shorthand for it. Really, it's practices containing the energy of desire. And okay, so we've got usually there's four classes of tantra, and usually we talk about the lower tantras, action tantra, and the highest yoga tantras. And the reason, because the other two middling tantras, those initiations aren't often given. So mostly it's the lower tantras and the highest yoga tantra. That's why there's more emphasis on them. And what determines whether they're lower tantras or higher tantras is the capacity, the strength of the practitioner. How much bliss you can take onto the path without getting into trouble. So this is like the smelling homework comes in handy, knowing our pain threshold, knowing our pleasure threshold. So what it depends on is our strength, and in particular, our strength of our motivation and our analysis, wisdom, realizing emptiness.
It's kind of like
So the six-session guru yoga, yeah, we did it throughout the day in six different individual sessions, but that's particularly to discipline for highest yoga tantra. That's the highest yoga tantra one.
So
yeah.
It's not
action tantra. No. Okay. No. Okay. And so it is very clearly delineated. So what happens if we get in over our head too fast? There's a couple of examples. So one is like when countries modernize too quickly, too much too fast. So if anyone went to Nepal 10 years ago, oh, how lovely. You go to Nepal now, to Kathmandu now, it looks just like this illustration. It's just completely polluted. And it's because it's too much, too fast. Didn't get everything together in time. Everything happened all at once and people weren't prepared. So there is a big danger that you can have what's quite a balanced life thrown into confusion if you're not prepared. Yeah, Tom.
No, I was just there.
You were just there, right, okay. Yeah, so again, it's like, oh, no, what have we done? Now that everything is so polluted, to unpollute it is much harder than if you had have just kept it nice and pristine to start with. Yeah, it's really difficult. Here's another example, a painter in the creative process. So I've seen many documentaries about various painters that are incredibly talented. They get so in the flow. They get a huge amount of sexual energy. They have lots and lots of partners and disastrous relationships, and like it all goes pear shaped, and then they end up, you know, crashing, drunk driving, and dying or something. You know, like, I mean, we've seen it. So this, what happens is that you have anything where you focus your mind and you let go of that sense of self will bring a sense of bliss. That's what happens. Just with ordinary things, just short order cooks, that'll happen. But if you don't know what to do with it and you follow that desire, number one, you'll get into a big mess with the relationships. Number two, you won't finish the painting. Two big disasters in my book. So that's to do with the desire, but I also wanted to just share with you a little bit, because it's taking all of the emotions onto the path. So, for instance, here's a little bit about taking anger onto the path. Like, who knew you could take the energy of anger onto the path? So this is from the English Geshe Tashi Seri, page 21. Here again, emptiness is the crucial factor. We go into the situation that made us angry, and then we meditate on emptiness while in that situation. Our understanding of emptiness will stop the anger, but not the energy. We then bring that energy into the process of visualization. It's kind of what you were saying, Ben. This is more profound than doing a meditation on developing compassion and love for an enemy. There, we're trying to destroy the anger by replacing it with its antidote, love. Such a practice can be effective with or without an understanding of emptiness. So it's like, you know, Mahayana Sutra and also lower practice. But with an understanding of emptiness, rather than eliminating the anger and its energy, we can transform it into something powerful. So it's a really different approach. It's completely different from what we've been used to. This working with the energy. I mean, another classic example is just any martial arts movies that you see, you know, like Jackie Chan or whatever. It's all about using the energy of the opponent. It goes with the energy. You know, there's some things that are blocking, but mostly you just keep your stamina by going with the energy. Yeah, rather than counterforce it, you just absorb the blow and you use it. You direct it. So it doesn't harm you and it doesn't harm them. It disables them, stops them doing any more mischief, as His Holiness would say. All right. So then let's look at the four classes of Tantra. So what we have up at the top, Action Tantra, the lower Tantras, otherwise Kriya Tantra. Then there's the middle Tantras, Performance Tantra and Yoga Tantra. And then there's Highest Yoga Tantra that we call HYT, Highest Yoga Tantra. So four classes of Tantra. There's the Sanskrit names for them as well. So the capacity, the lesser capacity practitioner for Action Tantra. And so because you're of lesser capacity, how you're mostly disciplined is by external activities. So ritual cleanliness, avoiding black foods, cleaning the environment and yourself and your clothes. So if anyone who's done Yungnaes, for instance, up at Chenrezig Institute, that's an Action Tantra practice. And so the main thing is to keep the body clean, keep your environment nice, wash all the time, and that's really easy. Your mind's going crazy, but it doesn't matter. You just keep your body nice. And you try and sit in a good position, you learn all the mudras, and slowly as you do the practice, because you're physically, you've been acting as if you're all together, then slowly the mind comes in as well. The mind gets tamed as well. So it's the easy way. So for those with the least capacity, that's how we're disciplined. So that's how it works. The performance tantra activities are external and concentration on equal importance. And so the meditations focus equally on external things and also internal concentrations. Yoga Tantra, mainly concentration. Then Highest Yoga Tantra, not relying on anything external at all. So there's nothing higher than this. Now, that can sometimes be misled as anything goes. And Lama Yeshe was really clear about this, that it's not, therefore I can just let rip and I can have dirty, smelly dreadlocks and I can be rude to everybody and smash mosquitoes. No. Not unless you can unsmash the mosquito. Otherwise, you've already, you know, necessarily had those other, you've got the other ones under control. So it means that you don't have to rely on anything physical to be able to channel your mind. Yep. And so there's an analogy for this, which is the type of bliss. So for Action Tantra, the type of bliss that you have the capacity to take onto the path is the joy of gazing backwards and forwards. So I kind of use the example of, say, you know, when you're a teenager, did anyone used to put pictures of rock stars or movie stars on the wall? Did anyone not do that? Yeah, quite a few. See, I don't know what kind of childhood he had, but you know, cut out all the things, and so you'd look at the rock star and you'd gaze at them and you'd be inspired, you'd be happy, you'd want to be like them. And you could gaze at them for hours. So I wanted to be like David Bowie. So I had every type of David Bowie manifestation plastered over my wall. And so, but then one day I went to the concert and like we're in the front row. And so then, of course, you think, oh, he looked at me. So that's the joy of gazing and smiling back and forth. Now suddenly, oh, he looked at me. So do you freak out when he looked at me, like at the Beatles, when everyone just lost it, like collective just madness, just screaming? Like I look at that as a phenomenon and just think, what the heck was happening there? That's just the joy of gazing back and forth. Oh, my gosh. So, okay, can you take that on and can you feel good about it, or do you just lose your mind? I mean, part of it might be to lose your mind, but then you've got to wake up the next morning. So you have, it's a little bit more. And so then the next one, oh, okay, so joy of gazing, smiling back and forth, and holding hands, so actual touch. So this is a little bit like if you get backstage and you get to meet the rock star. And so often what happens is you shake their hand and they go, oh, what's your name? And you go, I don't know. Nope, I've lost my mind. I have no idea. Or you become all stupid and giggly or something like that. But occasionally, I mean, this is, as you can tell, I'm a bit of an aging groupie. So, you know, occasionally you might get it together and go, hi, how are you? Having a nice time in Brisbane? So can you handle it or do you just lose it? And as for many groupies, the sorry story is you jump in bed with the person and it doesn't turn out well. So you might be able to handle it. It's very, very few people that can. Usually you're just used and abused and cast aside. But if then you can actually handle the joy of gazing, smiling back and forth, holding hands and union, actually the union, sexual union, say in this example, but union of our masculine and feminine energies without losing it. So the example that they give is like this one, this relationship one, because this is a universal experience. This is across cultures that we have. We understand it. But it's not about having sex. It's just an analogy. And this is how you can tell what's the amount of desirous energy that we're going to be able to handle in our meditation practice. And then when we get up from the meditation session and we go around and we're all blissed out, how are we going to react? How are we going to respond to people? Are we going to be all blissed out until someone says a nasty word to us and then we're just like really super angry? All of these things. Okay, so questions, comments? It's not progressive like that. No, the practices on Action Tantra are specifically that, on that level. And so they're the ones that you can have the least problems with and the least possibility of getting into trouble with. And so that's why we have those initiations first. So that's like practices. So Action Tantra deities, like Medicine Buddha initiation, Great Chenrezig initiation with Thousand Arm Chenrezig, Tara, Manjushri. There's also the Six Arm Mahakala and Lower Tantra, Vajrasattva, purification. So all of those practices, there are when you do the mantras and you're focusing at the heart, so you might get lung, which is when it's too much, or you might actually have that blissful energy that then powers you through the meditation and through the day. But you've got the least chance of losing it. But people still lose it. right? People still lose it on retreat. They have psychotic breaks. They have terrible pain in the heart because they've been focusing their energies all there at the heart and it's too much too soon, all of this kind of thing. And maybe because we haven't had instructions on what to do, like really specific instructions, and that's the beauty of having an actual lama that can give us actual verbal instructions. Yeah, so I don't know a huge amount about the Brahmin cultures, but yes, the point is to renounce the world. It's based on ethics. There's a lot of extreme practices. But there's a lot of practices that use tantric energies. And so there's a lot of like the yoga and the extreme breathing and things in yoga, and they're very, very similar to a high yoga tantra practices. But the goal is different. So the goal in Brahmanic traditions is to reach the pinnacle of samsara. It's still within samsara, so we are not free. But it's a very pure place because you're free of the gross disturbing emotions. But you haven't cut the root of samsara, so you're still within this cycle. So there's a fundamental difference about the purpose of Tibetan Buddhist practice. Buddhist practice is about becoming liberated from samsara and manifesting into a light body so that you can help others. So two really big things. Yeah, so big difference. Yeah. But the practices are the same. Like, you know, in terms of the channels, they're there. The chakras, they're there. How you move them around, really, really similar. But the purpose, also, of course, the Tibetan, the Buddhist practices are supposed to be secret. So you're not going to see someone on the road at the Kumbh Mela doing them. So these lower tantric deities, I have heard some people go, oh, I didn't know Medicine Buddha was Tantra, or I didn't know Chenrezig was Tantra. Yeah, they're action Tantra deities. They're lower Tantra deities. It is a tantric practice. Manjushri, orange Manjushri there, is a tantric practice. Tara is a tantric practice. Then, for instance, some highest yoga tantra deities, the white deity there right next to the words is the highest yoga tantra emanation of Vajrasattva. So Vajrasattva with the wisdom mother in union. And then next to him is Tara, Chidamani Tara. Looks pretty much the same as lower Tantra Tara. So you can just tell by the name and the practice, Chidamani Tara is a high Surga Tantra practice. Below that, my secret Hayagriva. So my secret Hayagriva was the last initiation that Lama Zopa Rinpoche gave in Australia, you know, before he passed away. And so that was an amazing initiation because my secret Hayagriva is two things, both a yidda, so an actual practice that you do and that you self-generate as and do all of the complicated things, and also a protector. And so normally protector practices, you are either yourself or whatever your deity is. It might be a lower tantra deity, and you have the protector outside of you and you ask the protector to help. So my secret Hayagriva has that dual aspect. And that's, so when that initiation was given at Chenrezi Institute, the little practice that we got to do was a protector practice. Very simple, really simple protector practice. And then everybody wanted to dive in deep and like, let's do the whole sadhana and everything. And it was like 50, 60 pages long, incredibly complicated, and people are going, what are the three principal aspects of the path? And the poor nun that was leading it was like, oh my gosh. So that was the reason it was given like that, was so we could do it as a protector practice. Huh?
Before COVID.
Before, that's right, just before COVID, wasn't it? and just before all of the huge upheavals throughout the world. The other really, the bigger one, the bigger image, that's Kala Chakra. So Kala Chakra is an initiation that will be given in Bendigo by Jado Rinpoche at the Great Stupa. So they would have put the Kala Chakra mandala on the ceiling of the Great Stupa. And so the retreat will be under that mandala.
Oh.
Yeah. So the Kala Chakra is it's a whole nother thing to itself. So when His Holiness the Dalai Lama gave that initiation in Australia in 1996, heaps of people came. So there were Buddhists that took it as an initiation, but there were also many non-Buddhists that went and they took it as a blessing. And he said, that's okay, have it as a blessing. So the initiation that will be given down in Bendigo will be a genung, so a subsequent permission. So those who already have the initiation can self-generate. Those who don't just have Kala Chakra in front. But it's still going to be spectacular. So I was thinking about the analogy of, you know, the genung or the great initiation. I was trying to think, what's a way to explain it? And one is, it's like the genangs or the subsequent permissions, they're like having the caravan. And the great initiation is like having the actual vehicle. So hopefully you get the vehicle and then you get the caravan and the boat and everything that comes along behind it. But occasionally you rock up and you just get the caravan. Yeah. So then, you know, then you have the blessing to do the practice, but you can't self-generate, so you can't go anywhere. Then one day you have a great initiation and now you can hitch that caravan on and off you go. Yes, that's why you have a blessing or a subsequent permission, but how you practice it changes. So if it's just the subsequent permission and you haven't had any great initiation, then you have the blessing to do the practice with the deity in front of you. Yeah. Okay, so... any other questions about these lower tantras or highest yoga tantra? Yabyum.
Yum yum.
Yum yum. No. Usually there's the male and then the female is the wisdom mother. Yes. It's never reversed.
Uh-huh.
But there is a term, yabyum.
Yes.
And I'm not sure what that means.
Apparently it's the opposite.
Oh, okay. Nope, never heard of it. Never heard of it ever being reversed, because what we're looking at is masculine and feminine energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not quite sure how the reverse would ever work. I don't even know if that would be Buddhist. It's nothing to do with gender. So it doesn't matter if you're whatever gender you are, it doesn't matter. If you have the initiation, for instance, of let's go back, of Manjushri, you arise as Manjushri. Whether you're a man or a woman, you arise as Manjushri because you have that masculine energy. And if you have an initiation as Tara, and it's a full initiation, you arise as Tara, whether you're a man or a woman, because it's nothing to do with gender. It's that energy. So some of these deities may have an implicit consort. So Tara or Vajragini, they may have a staff or something that is an implicit consort, but it's still there. But there was one time where a lady was talking with Eddie and saying, I really feel very uncomfortable arising as a man because, you know, I'm a lesbian and I just don't want to do that. And it's like, there's such a misunderstanding and such a lack of accessing your own potential, because it's about all of the whole spectrum of human experience, not limited to just being a man or a woman. So again, it's like we tend to concretize things and make them inherent, and they're not like that. They're really about the energies. And so I suppose if you feel uncomfortable about arising, in a masculine energy, it's because you've been disassociated from it. And so this is a chance of actually reconnecting with a huge amount of power that you haven't had access to before, or that has somehow been besmirched in your life. Yep.
Macy Jane asks, where will a HYT initiation for Vajrasattva be offered? Is that in September at Chenrezig?
No, don't think so. No, there are three major initiations being offered at Chenrezig Institute later on in the year, and I'm not sure if Haruka Vajrasattva is part of it. Haruka Vajrasattva is usually a subsequent permission. On the end of the last day, so possibly. But again, to do that, you have to it's a subsequent permission, so you have to have a previous highest yoga tantra initiation. And I would be very cautious about having your first initiation be a highest yoga tantra initiation. It's a really big deal, and if you ever regret it, it will just cut you off from your own life force. So closer to that time, Geshe Zopa will be giving a Vajrasattva initiation in July. And so that too, I think, will be a Jenang. So, but at least it'll give you an idea. So you be a subsequent permission, it'll be okay to take it. You won't need to have any other initiation before that. So a little taster. And we all need Vajrasattva.
And that's here, isn't it?
That will be here, Langri Tampa Centre. Yeah. Okay, so, wow, we've been a huge, covered a huge amount of ground tonight. So the four classes of Tantra. What determines, what distinguishes these four classes of Tantra is by how much bliss we can handle before getting into trouble. So remember, there's actually nothing wrong with good things, with pleasure, with bliss, with anything like that. There's nothing wrong. And in fact, we need good experiences to keep us going. We actually need them, but it's the grasping at them that's the problem. So ordinary and enlightened desire are directly opposed. So like an insect devouring attachment from within, or like a vaccine harnessing poison to destroy disease. And remember, within all of us is an unlimited source of male and female energy. Just as every atom has the potential for nuclear fission, but you've got to set it up right, and it takes a huge amount to set it up properly in either case, doesn't it? And deity practice, think of it like a mirror of our enlightened potential. So just like a Buddha has multiple facets of ways to benefit, wisdom, compassion, power, all of these things, multiple facets, so too we've got these multiple potentials. Okay, so the recommended reading, the four tantras, page 32, the four levels of attachment, page 33, and then next week, we're into the top shelf now, the four Buddha bodies, Dharmakaya and Rupakaya, and their causes and the power of visualization. And thank you very much for all of your, just before we do the prayers, thank you so much for your input and feedback about the smelling homework. I always find it fantastic to hear what everyone has to say. You're a very virtuous group. No, you keep them. Keep them in your... in your emergency pocket to just whip out so you can keep doing them. Let's dedicate. And for His Holiness's long life, Jitam dil pendil halu pa kan le jo we sabe yin no kadri so me ten tin ya so la so wa dem so tu je And for the swift recognition of Lama Zopa Rinpoche's reincarnation, and also for all of the most perfect, necessary, conducive conditions so that everything can turn out well, and may we strongly collect all of our good karma and our positive energy and our merits and offer it for the most perfect positive outcome. To so chan chin chan kyong kya we te zin kyong bel we kun so to po se cho son ko we le mon tu tru pa ta so du che kong tu shab te shu. Thanks very much, everybody.